And this is Live and Local, your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. Coming up, I will be talking with Michael Luxner, who is music director of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, sort of an unusual program for us. We will be focusing on one piece of music. Granted, it's a rather large one, the Sixth Symphony of Gustav Mahler, which the symphony will be playing Saturday night in Decatur. Tonight at 7 o'clock on the WYL-FM Evening Concert, however, it's the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with Jaap van Zweden conducting. You'll hear, quote, one of my best, unquote, as Beethoven put it, his Seventh Symphony. Also on the program, Ray Vaughan Williams' famous tuba concerto with CSO principal tubist Jean Pokorny as the soloist, and two works by Shostakovich, the Second Cello Concerto and the Chamber Symphony. It's the Chicago Symphony Orchestra tonight at 7 o'clock on the Evening Concert here on FM 90.9. Our program today is made possible with support from the Danville Symphony Orchestra, presenting the group Leahy and an evening of Celtic music topped with Irish song and dance this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Danville High School Auditorium. Ticket information is available at 443-5300. That's the opening music for several minutes from the first movement of the Sixth Symphony of Gustav Mahler here on Live and Local. It's going to be played on Saturday by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, Michael Luxner conducting. A little bit of a survey that we are taking of the complete work, which is sort of almost silly to try to do in a short radio program, but it's a piece that certainly bears discussion and analysis and also understanding, because as Michael indicated early on, it's a piece that has been misunderstood, has been discussed many times over, lots of arguments about it. Before we go into one of the other mottos that shows up periodically, Michael, I want to ask you about your relationship with the piece, and also why program it with the Millikan Decatur Symphony, because it's got to be a massive challenge for them.
Oh, well, it is for all of it. It is for any group of any orchestra, and it's not the first we've done. In fact, I've been at Millikan for 15 years, and we have done the first five symphonies, and I am emboldened to do the sixth because of the incredible support and reception we've gotten from our audience for the first five. I've had audiences in other cities complain on the most silly, superficial ground about Mahler symphonies. Oh, they're just too long, and oh, I just need more variety, and oh, it's so expensive, Michael. This is what you get from your board, or mm-hmm. something like that. But in Decatur, each one has been met with more and more approval and acclaim and satisfaction. And of course, I started with the ones that are very easy to go down, the second and the first and then the fourth and then the fifth and finally last the third. And now it's simply time, and there's absolutely no reason to shy away.
You got exposed to this piece as a kid.
That's true. It happens that the sixth was the first Mahler symphony to which I was exposed, and it was really at a time before I even knew hardly any of standard classical repertoire. I was an adolescent, really, growing up in the New York area during the heyday of Leonard Bernstein's music directorship in the early 60s. And he had inaugurated a Mahler cycle in 1961 at the on the 50th anniversary of Mahler's death. And then Lincoln Center opened in 1962, I think it was, or three. And shortly after that, just as I was getting into high school, starting high school, my dad got some tickets to a New York Philharmonic concert, and really at this point I was little more than a high school trumpet player in the band, just beginning to become aware of orchestra music, and I had a chance to go to an orchestra concert, and it happened to be the Mahler Sixth, and it was just an unforgettable experience. I'm sure I did not hear, you know, structural detail the way I might now, but what I heard was just an overpowering experience in terms of sound and emotion and effect. The orchestra, of course, is huge, and it has these unusual percussion things in it. And I also happened to be sitting in a place where I was looking directly at Maestro's profile. And although I was new to the world of orchestra and classical music, Leonard Bernstein as a cultural icon in the New York area at that time was huge. I mean, this was the era of the Young People's Concerts and his great celebrity and everything else. So it was utter. I was so close, I could almost see the beads of sweat on his face, and it was just an amazing experience. And as I, it was a few years after that that I did go to college, and then eventually became a music major and started studying scores in earnest. And so the sixth was the first Mahler score that I really chose to plunge myself into, with never dreaming that I might someday be conducting it. But just to study it, and interestingly found out later that even in the period of Mahler's eclipse, one might say that in the early 20th century, between his death and, say, 1960 or so, the era of the long-playing record and the era of full-time orchestra contracts, when people were then finally able to get these things played at a high level and people could listen to them over and over again and absorb them and learn them, Mahler was not well known and not well understood, probably not played very well or very often. But even in that period, in the 30s and 40s, I found out later that the avant-garde, the young composers of that era, the ones who were born around the time that Mahler died, were fascinated by the sixth because of its taut classical structure and its incredible polyphony, the way it layers melodies on top of the other with it's seemingly effortless skill and its use of motives, and it's just a very tightly constructed, brilliantly written score that has always held a great fascination for cognoscenti and musicians. But during that period was slow to be accepted by the public. It was, I also learned, the last of the Mahler symphonies to receive a first hearing in the United States. It was not heard in the United States until 1947, even once.
And even he had some trouble getting it across to his audience.
Yes. Mahler said that he himself had trouble conducting it. Of course, in his lifetime, it was only mostly his own performances that allowed these things to get known, and he said he had trouble with the sixth, and he changed his mind on certain details, including big detail, the order of the inner movements, which has resulted in this being a controversy to this very day. But he at one point said that only a later generation, which has fully, I'm quoting now, fully absorbed and digested my first five symphonies, will really understand the sixth. And then, meanwhile, he moved on. He only really conducted it, I think, four times in his lifetime, and then moved on and started to have some more popular success. For instance, the eighth was the one real triumph he had during his own lifetime. So the sixth just sort of lingered for a while, I think. And to this day, people will say, you know, that's the one I have a hardest time with. And other people will say, oh, that's absolutely the best.
Well, we've heard some of the opening of the first movement, so we've gotten kind of the kernels of some of the things that are going on. There's a phenomenon that shows up in this movement, and I think in some of the other movements as well, cowbells show up. He's Mahler said at various times, or maybe other people said about his symphonies, I can't now remember, maybe both, that a Mahler symphony encompasses the entire world, any Mahler symphony, and in a way, so there's all elements of nature and humankind, including in his day, something about cowbells.
Well, the cowbells are a metaphor for certain passages in the work. And they appear in three of the movements, and the one we're about to play is from the absolute dead center of the first movement, and it's not the cow. Well, it is the cowbell. Mahler said himself in a footnote in the score that the cowbells represent the last earthly sound from the valley far below, heard by a departing spirit on the mountaintop. So, if you can imagine. And he doesn't say anything about death or resurrection or, you know, heaven or anything that you can say is specifically religious. There is just this sense of great distance from the actual world. And I don't know if that mountaintop is real or metaphorical, but if you can imagine being in a state of awareness or consciousness or spirituality that is very rarefied and very detached and very pure, and sort of the last tangible thing that is just slipping away from you is some sound of real life. You know, the cowbells symbolize that. They are far below. They are, as you say, part of nature. But it's not just the cowbells themselves, but the kind of music he writes whenever the cowbells appear. This transcendent spirituality that is just as much a part of Mahler as any tragedy or any love theme.
One of the appearances of cowbells and the associated spiritual, calm music that occurs periodically throughout the Sixth Symphony by Mahler, from this one coming from the middle of the first movement. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly with Michael Luxner, conductor of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra. And you referred very early in this conversation, Michael, to the fact that this symphony, though called the Tragic Symphony, is certainly not unrelentingly so, as we just heard, for that matter. And the second movement, well, the Andante movement, mm-hmm. since there is some question, does it belong first or second? You're going to be playing it second.
Yes.
Is itself unrelentingly not tragic.
Just utterly beautiful, and you know, when one says Mahler slow movement, one sometimes can be forgiven for thinking adagissimo or something like this.
Meaning really, really, really slow.
Really, 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 because sometimes he is. But this is not one of those Mahler adagios. It's an andante. It sings. It's just an absolutely lyrical, effortless. I'm not to say without shape or episodic variety. But its main idea is a thoroughly sweet and tender, caressing melody that, when it ends, has a kind of rocking closing figure, that an undulating figure that just reminds me of a rocking cradle with a sleeping infant in it. Just a completely calm, touching, an totally untroubled sense of being at one with oneself in the world.
That's the opening portion of the Andante movement, the slow movement, which will be played as the second movement in the performance of Mahler's Sixth Symphony by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, which will be happening Saturday night under the direction of Michael Luxner, who's my guest here on Live and Local this hour, exploring Mahler's Sixth Symphony. I do know that we've never done this sort of a conversation on this show before, but when I saw, Michael, that you were programming the piece, I thought, how do you simply have a conversation about the concert and say, oh, we're playing Mahler 6, come out and hear it?
By the way, yeah.
Might as well try to understand it a little bit. And
I spent my entire summer on this piece.
I'm sure you did, some.
And of course, the score and all the parts and just everything I could find to read about it, and have just been immersed in this. So it's... I can go on for a while if you want.
Well, we have two movements to get through, although we'll really be sampling just a little bit of them. We've sort of described the world of this particular symphony a bit. The scherzo movement, which in many performances and recordings comes as the second movement. You're going to be playing it as the third movement, mm-hmm. which is kind of the conventional classical way to do it. You have the opening movement, you have the slow movement, you have your minuet or scherzo, mm-hmm. and then you have the final movement. Mm-hmm. And this kind of an indication that, at least in your vision at this point, it is maybe the most classical of Mahler's 9+ symphonies.
It absolutely is in those terms. Not since the first.
Classical meaning like Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven,
yes,
those guys.
Right, exactly. As far as following the classical models goes, the 6 is by any measure the closest. Even in Beethoven's day, of course, the scherzo of the 9th symphony is second. That's not really part of the argument. The argument is simply that he wrote it one way. Before he even performed it for the first time, he changed his mind and insisted that something be slipped into the score to say that from now on it should be done not the way he published it. And it probably would have taken, except that a certain editor at a certain point in the mid-century, well, the editor of the first critical edition for the Mahler Society, Edwin Ratz, chose the other way on very flimsy evidence, and it was published that way. And then most of the parts started coming out with the scherzo second. Now the new critical edition has come out, which claims to prove absolutely definitively that it should be Andante scherzo. However, as soon as that came out, of course, the partisans of the other side who want to trust Mahler's original impulse, but not the thing he ever actually did, still insist on scherzo first. In fact, musically, there are good arguments both ways.
Well, musically, let's have us a sample of the scherzo part. So the scherzo literally means joke.
Mm-hmm.
Beethoven kind of got that idea going in his symphonies. Implies, you know, very fast and but what kind of a joke is this?
Yeah, well, in the same way, Chopin also wrote scherzi for piano, which are not funny. they
could be a sick joke.
Well, maybe we should say satiric or ironic or something like that. Actually, the scherzo of the Mahler Sixth is really not very different from an element of fantasy that has been in many of his symphonies up to this point, and that is the roots of the scherzo are as the dance movement of the symphony, and Mahler in several earlier symphonies toys with the scherzo as kind of a dance of death, but not in a maudlin way, but the kind of almost a cartoonish way. The way we think of dancing skeletons, say, or old medieval woodcuts of bones rattling and that kind of thing. It's a little bit like Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre, that kind of thing. That's playing on the tradition of the almost the Halloweenish sense of that kind of dance and scherzo.
Here's the first appearance of the scherzo in Mahler's 6th symphony here on Live and Local. Thank you. Some of the scherzo of Mahler's Sixth Symphony, this performance by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Bernhard Haitink, and it will be played, of course, the symphony in its entirety, Saturday night by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, Michael Luxner conducting. He's my guest on Live and Local. The longest work by the longest movement by quite a stretch is the last movement, the fourth movement, and we're going to give it the shortest shrift, actually, partly because...
You might as well. This you can't even begin to encompass it. Like the Beethoven Ninth, like the great Schubert C major, this symphony is entirely weighted toward its finale. The finale is the center of gravity. As amazing as the first three movements are, and I could talk about any one of them all day, it is as though you're just flicking them off the palm of your hand with a finger of your other hand. When the finale starts, you can just tell from that opening vortex of sound with which the show opened today that you're in for the most amazing 30 minutes you've ever heard. And one of the books I was reading by Michael Kennedy summed it up very well, is that although it's by far the longest movement, it is so packed with incident that it seems almost compressed. It's just an utterly amazing universe unto itself.
Well, we will content ourselves with discussing one element of this movement, which is one that you commented to me a while ago that is more than a little bit overhyped, but nonetheless has some importance to it. And this has to do with the notion of these hammer strokes,
the hammer strokes,
that show up here. What's that all about?
And, well, it's a very important element in the symphony, and I don't mean to, when I say it's been overhyped, there's a controversy about it among Mahlerites about to how many hammer strokes there should be, and that has become such an issue that if one were to run a Google search, say, on Mahler 6, you'd probably wind up reading 18 articles or furious letters to the editor about hammer strokes, and that is totally out of proportion to what this symphony as a whole has to offer. But they are still important. And the story is simply that Mahler, at two climactic points in the score, writes for a sudden blow of a hammer. And that's what he calls it, a hammer. And he does not specify what instrument should do it, but he does write in a footnote that it should be a short, dry, dull stroke of non-metallic quality, like the blow of an axe. And it's like a blow of fate. It was never achieved to his satisfaction in his lifetime. The problem being that, of course, that it can't sound like, you know, say, the crack of the bat in a baseball game, because that's too bright. It's not dull enough. And so how do you get something that has both that sense of dullness and still can carry, you see? It cannot be a bass drum. It's not supposed to have resonance. It has to be like a thud, but very loud. And so we have actually had special equipment built in order to achieve this effect.
Why not just get a big axe and a big hunk of wood?
Well, it wouldn't be loud enough.
That's it, huh?
Yeah, I mean,
even on a resonating board or something.
Yes, there has to be resonance, but it can't sound like resonance, like from a membrane or something. I mean, if you're chopping down a tree, you will hear the thud. But someone 50 feet away with 90 other instrumentalists playing a climactic note will not feel it. It has to come in on top.
So what's the point of it? What's it about?
It's a blow of fate. It appears at two times when the hero, or the metaphorical hero, the in this tragic essay, there is striving, there is nobility, there is an effort to face down whatever it is that is the fate, and the hammer cuts it off and sends the entire structure into chaos and turmoil.
So here's the first of those two appearances from the final movement of Mahler's Sixth Symphony here on Live and Local. That's a portion of the fourth movement of the Sixth Symphony of Gustav Mahler, the first of the two appearances of these hammer strokes, the strokes of fate, figure in there, and heard here on Live and Local. And you have been listening to a conversation between myself, Kevin Kelly, and Michael Luxner, music director and conductor of the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra, who will be performing the entire Sixth Symphony, along with music by Silvestre Revueltas, Sensemaya, on Saturday's concert at 7:30 at the Kirkland Fine Arts Center on the Millikan University campus in Decatur. We are going to leave the rest of the last movement to your discovering its sound world, if you're able to attend that concert. And if you're not, go buy, break out, borrow a recording of the piece, because it really is worth your time, as I'm sure you have discovered from Michael's enthusiasm and knowledge about the piece and just how much is in this piece of music. And it's been great, Michael, to explore this with you. Haven't had that chance before, and I hope we'll have another chance to explore something in depth with you again.
I'll look forward to it.
Michael Luxner on Live and Local. We have support for our show today from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. With wine, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer, wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. And full disclosure, I'd said earlier that all the excerpts we played were from a recording made by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra and conductor Bernhard Haitink in the 60s and 70s, and in fact, the last excerpt I played with the hammer blow, I did not use that recording because, frankly, it hardly makes any impact the way he recorded it so clearly. As Michael described, he didn't do what needed to be done. So the Telarc label always used to trumpet its ability to give bass drums lots of impact, so I figured a Mahlerian hammer blow would do the same. So that was a recording by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra conducted by Yoel Levy. We're going back, however, to the Concertgebouw and Bernhard Haitink. I'm going to play the last 5 or so minutes of the opening movement, which ends with the Alma theme, as Michael described, in a particularly joyous fashion. And you're listening to Live and Local. Closing minutes of the first movement of Mahler's Sixth Symphony here on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Hope you enjoyed this survey of the piece. Well, not even just a survey, a full discussion from somebody who has spent an awful lot of time and effort studying it. Coming up in just about a minute, we have All Things Considered from NPR. Some concerts you can go here in our area tonight. Ensemble Bassiani, who are a group of male singers from the country of Georgia, will be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at 7:30 in Urbana. Illinois State University's faculty flutist Kim Reisinger is giving a recital tonight at Kemp Recital Hall on the ISU campus in Normal. That's also at 7:30. Emily Otness and Justin Rondon will be at Clark Bar in Champaign tonight at 7 o'clock. University of Illinois jazz faculty are at the Iron Post in Urbana tonight at 7 o'clock. And that is it. Today's broadcast made possible with support from the 6th Annual Disability Expo, reaching out for answers on Saturday, October 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Lincoln Square Village in Urbana. This is a family-friendly event with entertainment and activities for children and adults. This is 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. It's just about 5 o'clock.